Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, Dialect's Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant in 2002 from the Scarman Trust. We're on Bristol Community FM, 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com. This week, it's community activist for many years, many decades in fact, from Bath, that's John Bamfield. Talks about the history of trade unions and Bath Press, etc. over there. And we hear from Julian Clegg, who works for BBC Radio Solent. That's actually my old station. I worked there for a year, about 1991, 1992. And he interviews Jill Golding, who found a suitcase in her loft from her grandfather, who won a DSO in World War II. In fact, he was the commander of coastal forces for the Royal Navy. And yet he died mysteriously just a few weeks after the end of the Second World War. And her story is revealed back in August 2015. A blue plaque was put down in Hayling Island for her grandfather, Harold Golding. Then we hear from Quentin Rees, who's a friend of Jill's, and he wrote a book also about the Royal Navy in World War II entitled Cockleshell Canoes. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk. We're based at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft on Jamaica Street. And I'll give you our contact details at the end of the show. So I'm joined now by a long-time activist from Bath, John Bamfield. But John, just to clarify for listeners, you've got quite a strange spelling of your name. I suppose that's a bit rude to say strange, but it's quite awkward. In other words, if people put Bamfield onto the internet, they won't find you, will they? How do you spell your name?
Bamfylde.
Okay, so that's John. He's joining us on Dialect today. Now, you're a long-time trade unionist. How did you first get involved? What's your earliest membership of a union, and why were you attracted to the unions?
I come from a long-time Labour family. I grew up in a Labour Party family, and this was a time when the Labour Party was more than it is now. I lived on a council estate, and my dad was the ward secretary. But in those days, this was back in the 50s, the Labour Party didn't only do political stuff, it was social. So they used to organise mass Christmas parties and trips to the seaside and stuff like that.
Well, I can remember that. Actually, where I come from in South London, you sometimes get invited along to the Labour Party Christmas do, and it was quite a big event. So is that still happening in Bath or not?
No. There's very few people in the members of the working class in the Labour Party.
Okay, so well, tell us a bit more about your dad. What unions was he in, and why was he so interested in the party?
I think he was in the TGWU.
Transport General Workers.
Yeah. He worked at Avon Rubber in Melksham. And as I say, when he was very active in the Labour Party in the 50s and 60s. He was also involved in the mutinies in the British Army at the end in 1945. I don't know if you know anything about that.
No, tell us.
Well, in 1945, my dad was in Burma.
Well, that's Myanmar, they call it now, don't they? With Aung San Suu Kyi and the problem with the Rohingyas right now, but this is back in the 50s.
Yeah.
It was originally...
No, it was in 1945.
In the 40s, right. And this was originally a British colony.
Yeah, but what happened was when my dad was in the territorials in the 30s, so he was called up immediately, the war broke out. And in those days, what they did, they joined for 3 years or the duration of the war. Well, where in 1945, when the war finished, and because it finished so sudden in the Far East because the Americans dropped the bomb on Hiroshima, nationalist groups took over all the old colonies, Indonesia, which had been Dutch, French Indochina, which is now Vietnam, and Malaya. And because the Japanese just surrendered, nationalist groups like Ho Chi Minh people in Vietnam, took over. And they wanted to disarm the nationalist groups and give the colonies back to either the French, Dutch or the British.
Right, so there was immediately a problem at the end of the war, a competition between the occupying forces and the indigenous people.
That's right, yeah. But because this is a thing that they've kept quiet, but because, like, the soldiers weren't that political, but they had joined to fight in the war, and the war was over.
So well, to fight the Japanese or the Germans or the Italians or whatever.
So they didn't see why they had to go in and give, was it? So about two-thirds of the British Army in India and Burma went on strike. They refused to get sent to Malaya or French Indochina or Indonesia. And in the end, the colonial powers rearmed the Japanese to put down the nationalists.
So, Amanda, I mean, how far up the chain of command did that go then? Was this officers as well involved, or was it just enlisted
men? No, it was just troops.
Yeah.
But I was in the army. If you can't get the troops to do anything, then you can't do anything. Officers can't do everything.
Yeah, maybe they should send the officers to do it on their own, eh?
Yeah.
So, okay, so your dad was involved in that. Were there consequences?
No, there's too many. And, of course, by this time it was a Labour government under Attlee. So they didn't push it that much. They just found other ways around the problem.
Okay, so when your dad came out of the army, what did he get involved in then?
He worked for my granddad for a bit in a cycleware workshop. And then because of a family problem, he left that and went to work for Bath Avon, to Avon Rubber.
Okay, but how about for you then? So did you start in hospitals, or was it a while before you were working there?
No, I left school at 15 with no qualification. And I worked, first of all, I worked in the garage. Then I worked, I did a two-year apprenticeship in supermarket managing. I'd hated it. So when I finished that, I joined the army.
Oh, crikey. So, you followed in your dad's footsteps in the army. How did you find that? Was it time of national service or volunteered?
No. National service was over by the time I joined.
So, okay, what regiments were you in? What did you do in the army?
I was in the Royal Corps of Signals. And so I mainly did switchboard, telephone switchboard, teleprinters. That was basically it.
And were you involved in any of the conflicts at the time?
Only in Northern Ireland, right at the end of my service.
So what was happening over there?
This was the outbreak of the current round of troubles in 1970. And we got sent there in 1969, but then it was mainly street riots. And sort of the police. The problem with Northern Ireland then is there was the police, and there was a group called the Beast Special, which is a kind of a police militia, and they were completely Protestants. Their ideals was of controlling areas was they had armoured cars, and you've got to remember they're a police force, and they used to drive around shooting all the windows out of the Catholic areas.
Crikey. So how did the army fit in, or didn't it, with the police force in Northern Ireland in the early parts of the Troubles?
Well, what happened was because the police couldn't control the situation, they put the army on the streets. And when I was there, it was a Labour government. And when we went on the streets, what people forget now is the Catholics come out and give us cake and coffee and that lot because they've seen us as protecting them from the police force. And it's only when the government changed that, and because of the link between the Tory party and the Ulster Unionists, that's when they started clamping down on the Catholics much more.
Well, that's interesting because that's happening today as well, isn't it? Right now, we've got this deal that's been done between the Ulster Unionist Party and the Conservatives to keep them in power, even though actually it's a minority government we've got with the Conservatives.
So, yeah, that's right, yeah.
Okay, so what was it like on the ground then? Were you actually out on the streets, or as I imagine, signals? You'd be in some barracks somewhere or whatever, quite safe.
No, I was on the ground at times. One of the things that we used to do is, because signals is communications, we used to do post runs around Belfast, and I used to go with a driver with some machine gun to protect him, sort of thing.
And what was the reaction from the public? Was it similar in the Catholic areas in Belfast or the Protestant areas, or different?
At the time, there wasn't that much things like sniping or stuff like that. It was mainly street demonstrations, which used to be quite big. And And both sides just have a go at the army now and again.
What did actually seeing what was going on the ground over there, what did it teach you about the roots of the conflict and maybe how to sort out things in Northern Ireland?
I was more sympathetic to the Catholics, basically, because...
Why?
Because I actually talked to some of the people we arrested, and I had this conversation with this kid we had arrested, who was Catholic, and they had burnt out a bakery. And talking to him, I said, "Why did you burn that bakery?" And he said, "Well, they had a sign saying there were jobs going there, but when he went there, they asked him, the first thing they ever asked you was what school you went to, and because it was segregated education. And if it's a Catholic school, there's no vacancies. Because most of the businesses were owned by Protestants and they wouldn't employ Catholic workers."
It was a unique sort of situation, actually, in Northern Ireland, because most of the towns had completely separate businesses for Catholics, not just the churches. You know, you might get your cobblers, your supermarket, almost every type of business you can imagine, your butchers, etc. There'd be a Catholic one and a Protestant one, and the Catholics would use one and the Protestants use another. A lot of people don't realise that.
Yeah, the big thing was housing, council housing. In council housing, a single person Protestant would be given a house in front of Catholic families, and they used to fix it so because of the votes. It always was. There was a joke in Derry that every election, half the Protestant graveyard voted because they'd never been taken off the register. And would turn up and vote in their names.
Crikey. Well, I mean, that was at the roots of a lot of people don't realise that actually the whole sort of electoral politics and whether you could vote or not was at the roots of a lot of the troubles.
Yeah, you also had, died out in Britain, in the rest of the UK in 1946, is businessmen had two votes. They had a vote for where they lived and a vote where their business was. That was general in British politics, but I think they got rid of it in 1945 in the rest of the UK.
Amazing. Anyway, so after the army?
I went and got a job. I worked in a geriatric hospital for about 2 or 3 years. And sort of, I was part of the first strike in the National Health Service ever.
Why was that?
Because I was an ancillary worker, I was a ward orderly, and the money was really bad. So we came out on a national strike, and it was the first strike ever in the National Health Service. It was a national strike.
What was it like working in those days? Because I understand in the 60s and early 70s, it was actually quite easy to get a job if you could, you know, if you didn't like your boss, unlike today. In fact, it's the opposite to today. If you don't get on with your boss now, you've just got to bite your tongue and knuckle down because it's difficult to get another one. But back in the late 60s, early 70s, you could walk out of one job into another, couldn't you?
It used to be a lot different. You didn't have the industrial protection. Like, there's no industrial tribunals or... And you could get sacked on the spot. But how it's different today is even in places I worked with the management on our necks all the time, and no union, we wouldn't dream of not taking a dinner hour and working overtime without being paid like they do all the time now. People work for their dinner hours and work loads of hours without being paid for it. Even though we were in ununionised places, we'd never do that. We wouldn't dream of doing it. It was unknown. And the bosses would never ask us to do it either.
A different world, it sounds like.
It was a different world. And the other thing was people would cheat the manager and get sacked on the spot on a Friday. And we'd arrange to meet them in the pub on the Monday. And they say, "I'm going down the labour exchange." We used to call it labour exchange in those days. And when they come in, you wouldn't say to them, "Have you found a job?" You say, "Where are you working?" Because... it was so easy to find jobs.
Amazing. Yeah. Okay, so what about Bath Press? What was that like to work there?
I left the NHS because the money was so lousy. And I got a job with Bath Press. I actually went there for a summer job. And then they kept me on. I wasn't a printer. I was a forklift truck driver, and I got trained. They were very strict on what was this. I had to get a certificate to drive, British Safety Standard certificate. I sort of got interested in union work, and I worked my way up to the convener. So by the time I left, I was the convener.
Well, I mean, this is this enormous building. As you drive into Bath from Bristol on the A4 on the right-hand side, it looks like some sort of, like, derelict, completely derelict now, Bath Press.
Yeah, it's been shut down for a long time.
So what happened there? It was just no money in printing anymore?
Well, I think a lot of the work went to the Far East. For about 10 years, it was really... working there, it was really sort of, so we had full orders and stuff like that. And then about 3 or 4 years before I left, it started getting rough. But I'd left before they closed down.
But, I mean, Bath is a centre for publishing and printing. Well, I don't know about printing nowadays, but things like Future Publishing in Bath is enormous. A lot of these glossy magazines, that I must admit, I pick them up and just put them down straight away because it didn't seem to be much worth reading in them, that we get in Smiths and all around the country in newsagents and this kind of thing, are published in Bath at Future. What sort of things were being produced at Bath Press? Was it magazines?
No, books? It's books.
What? Just books.
Books.
Oh, okay.
So 2/3 of the workforce were women because they would sew the ends up and sort of what I say. You had quite a sort of system. You had the craft workers, which were the printers, and they were top sort of thing. And then you had manual workers like me, semi-skilled. And then you had the women, basically. And when I went there, there was no woman on the union committee. It's all basically all crass. And I was the first semi-skilled worker to get on the union committee. And when I got a bit of influence, I suggested that we elect people to the union committee by section. And because some of the sections were entirely women, that means we got them onto the union committee.
Did it make a difference?
It did. We were quite well organised. We had a closed shop.
Right, so if you were working there, you had to be in the union.
That's right.
And, I mean, sometimes with the closed shop, people say if you wanted a job in a place, in the old days under the closed shop system, you didn't go to talk to the manager. You didn't send a letter or your CV to the boss. You went to the union to get the job.
No, at Bath Press, the management hired people. We now and again influence them to get rid of people, mainly on health and safety aspects. We used to take students on in the summer because of the holidays, and some of these students would get on the forklifts and drive about, and despite being warned several times, but they had no training on that lot. And people don't realise it. In an enclosed area, forklifts are as deadly as a car, and if people don't know what they're doing, they sort of kill people. When I was working at Bath Press, they had introduced youth opportunity programs. Can you remember those? And in the Southwest, 3 of these kids were sent by the job centres to work on various sites, which weren't as strong in health and safety as we are, but got killed in 1 year.
God. I mean, the other thing, of course, with the forklift is you could even easily overturn the thing if you haven't got the right, you know, because I imagine a few pallets of books can weigh a ton almost.
What you got to watch is when you're driving forklifts, it's the higher the forks go, the more weight goes on them. It's a thing. If you're lifting something down from high, what is it? And I have trouble with my hands because you can't drive forklifts and wear gloves out in the cold because you know how once you're a skilled driver, you tell by the weight through the controls whether it's going to tip or not. And if you wear gloves, it don't do that. So I have problems with my fingers now and again because they got so cold, basically.
It is a different world. We said that earlier. But, I mean, the idea of thousands and thousands of books being printed and published every month in Bath. Nowadays, what is Bath for? I mean, you know, the Romans used to love the spa and everything. But where's the industry? What's happened to it?
it's all... well, let me tell you about the council. The council in Bath are mainly Lib Dems and Tories. The Tories are controlled at the moment. And they're interested in three things. Tourists, students, and people coming in from outside to do shopping in the luxury shops. Bath is very different than when I was growing up.
Because that's funny, because none of those are the people that actually vote them in. The tourists don't have a vote. Most of the students are from outside the city, and only if they're registered will have a vote. And the same with the shoppers, outside. Most of them from outside the city.
Yeah, but that's how the wealth is made, because there's no... Like, when I was a kid, we used to have Stoddarts and Pitts in Bath, which was one of the biggest crane makers in the world. And they used to be all along the river, but it's all luxury housing now.
Amazing. So... I suppose that I don't want to be too cynical, but I wonder if the council are just thinking, well, we just want money coming into the city from outside so that we can then tax it. And is that their thinking?
It's just the way it's grown up, and most of the council are businessmen or attached to, there are jobs, but they're Mickey Mouse jobs, basically, you know, sort of just above the minimum wage, mainly people young, zero-hour contracts. Even some of the big employers, my son worked at a hospital for a time on a zero-hour contract until he managed to get a proper contract and work full-time there.
So is there any industry left in Bath?
Very little. The two biggest employers in Bath now is the university and the National Health Service.
After Bath Press, was there anything that made you decide, right, I've had enough at Bath Press? Could you see it going down? Was that the reason?
No, what happened was I saw an advert for an access course. So I applied and I did from the access course, I went to university and got a degree in industrial relations.
Right. So that's interesting. So as a mature student?
That's right.
Actually at Bath University?
At Bath University, yeah.
And how did you find that? How long was it?
It was a 1 year on the access course, which was at Bath College. And then it was supposed to be a 4-year course on the industrial relations course. But they waived a year for me because the third year was a placement. But he decided to get personal experience, but he decided being a convener of a major print factory for a long time was enough to... So I didn't do the year's placement.
I mean, before we skip completely away from Bath Press, as a convener, what sort of things were you doing?
Mainly health and safety issues.
Because nowadays it's very different. A lot of times people are afraid to raise health and safety issues either in hospitals or on building sites because they fear of being blacklisted. And yet, to you, it was your bread and butter.
Yeah, I was never frightened of the management. And sort of I would argue with them. And sometimes we had disagreements at union meetings, and we used to have the factory meetings with everybody there. I moved it. We should have support the Whopping dispute, which was a big print strike. But there was a lot of antagonism between General Print, which we were in the newspapers. So they voted not to support it. And so I lost quite heavily. And then somebody else sort of wanted me moved as a convener. They wanted to do it. But on the vote, 98% of the people in the meeting voted for me, and I asked some of them afterwards why they voted for me, why they had disagreed with what I'd proposed, and they said, well, we may disagree with you, but we know that you will go and argue with the management on our behalf, sort of thing.
Maybe you could talk a bit about Whopping, because that was enormous, wasn't it? I mean, I know there were even differences between print unions and journalism unions, and it was really all about Rupert Murdoch's decision to move out of Fleet Street to Whopping.
Well, at the time, before Whopping, printers were fair. I was in SOGAT, which was a print union, and we were very, very strong. Even in general print, we were strong. So Thatcher decided to break the back of the print unions. And That's what she did. But I went up. I went up a few times to the picket lines, and the picket lines were really quite rough. There's one night where the police beat up so many people and injured so many of the pickets and a crowd supporting them. They brought in another police force to investigate them. And the other police force, I think it was Surrey or somewhere, wanted police officers charged with everything from attempted murder to assault. But then when the first group come into court, it took so long for the inquiry that the judge ruled that too long had gone by for these police officers to get a fair trial sort of thing. So the whole case collapsed.
A whopping... do you think it was just a kind of Luddites? Because this was a lot of it was to do with the new technology, wasn't it?
It was partly. No, it wasn't. It wasn't. It was a continuation of Thatcher's aims to destroy the trade union movement.
But what Rupert Murdoch was doing is he was introducing what we would now call just desktop publishing, rather than the old hot metal system where you'd get you probably know the terminology and the jargon better than I do.
Well, we changed at Bath Press at this period from hot metal to more computer-centred printing without a problem. And it could have been done without all this hassle. One of our problems was, like I said, I might get sued, but Brenda Dean, our general secretary, had made secret deals with Murdoch. And so we were fighting with one hand tied behind our back, basically.
So your general secretary, your union's general secretary, had got secret agreements with the management.
Yeah, she wasn't interested in the strike whatsoever. She's now a senior member of the British Airport Authority.
Right, interesting. So, okay, so what was at the nub of the Whopping dispute then, if it wasn't about the change of technology and the control of the print unions over?
Well, it's basically about breaking the back of the trade union movement in this country. You had the miners and you had the printers, and they were probably the two strongest sections.
Oh, okay.
So they broke the miners and they broke the printers as well.
That was all during the 1980s. What year are we talking about?
I don't know. Well, the miners' strike was 84, 85, and Whopping was after that.
That was John Bamfield from Bath, and we'll have more from John next week.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
The life of a forgotten hero of World War II will be commemorated on Hayling Island today. Commander Harold Wilkinson Goulding made dozens of clandestine landings in enemy-occupied Europe and trained hundreds of others for the difficult and dangerous work. But details of his incredible career only emerged after the discovery of a suitcase containing secret documents. Our East Hampshire and Isle of Wight reporter Dominic Blake has more and joins me from Hayling Island. Good morning, Dominic.
Good morning, Jules.
And also alongside you, the granddaughter of Harold Goulding, DSO, so we shall talk to her shortly. This is an amazing story, Dominic. What a find, and he was definitely quite a character.
Yes, absolutely, Jules. A very successful and skillful mariner, first and foremost. He started his career in the Merchant Navy, had his first command at the age of 25, and became a Trinity House pilot as a very young man. And, of course, when war broke out, his intimate knowledge of the coast of France was incredibly valuable. Now, he was also a very brave man, as well as having these exceptional navigation skills. And all of that was put to good use by the Secret Intelligence Service, by SOE, and by the commandos. And, in fact, Commander Goulding conducted around 70 landings in person, more than any other officer in World War II. And as you say, he trained hundreds of other men here at the shore bases on Hayling Island, which made up HMS Northney. And his career progressed. He went on to become a commander of the Special Boat Unit, which is a predecessor of the SBS. And he went on to become Commodore Coastal Forces. So he was really at the centre of the action right through D-Day and beyond, Jules.
And Dominic, then the mystery of the suitcase. Tell us more.
Well, that's right. Very little was known about his exploits. He got a DSO, he was mentioned in dispatches, but very, very little public knowledge about what he'd done. And in fact, he sadly died in 1945, aged just 41, without even being able to tell his family much about what had been achieved. And after he died, just to show how important he was, the Chief of Combined Operations at the time, Major General Robert Laycock, actually wrote to his son to pay tribute to a man he described as his friend, but to explain that his father's work would have to remain secret. But then, in 2010, this extraordinary discovery, his granddaughter Jill came across a case full of papers in the attic, which began to show just how important that secret work was, and it's inspired her to arrange some pretty amazing commemorations today, Jules.
Yes, and I'm looking at the rundown for later, a flotilla, a flypast, and the unveiling of two blue plaques later. Let's talk to Jill Goulding, the granddaughter of Commander Harold Goulding, DSO. Jill, a very good morning to you.
And a good morning to you, Julian.
Yeah, tell us a bit more about grandfather's exploits and how you discovered more about them.
As Dominic said, I found an attaché case in the loft, in my mother's loft, along with my mother when we were clearing it out. And we broke into it because it was locked and found all these top secret documents, which was fantastic. And I then started researching because the documents on their own, of course, I didn't know what they really meant. So it's 5 years of work and we've come to this day today, which actually, along with happy birthday to all your other people, it was his birthday today too.
Oh, really? So that's very appropriate. I'm sure that was in your mind when you were thinking about this special day. Take me through what you've managed to organise, because I'm really impressed with this. The flotilla.
Yes, that's correct. The flotilla is at least 4 World War II Cockle canoes. There's a Mark 1, a Mark 2, a Mark 7, and a Mark 8, and possibly a Mark 9. We're not sure about that yet. We've also got a Spitfire coming and a Dakota. The Dakota is very relevant, although he was naval. He flew in a Dakota from Belgium back to Northolt with the very first surrender papers from Germany, from Aachen.
And 2 blue plaques being unveiled today. We must mention this. How's that happening?
Yes, the British Plaque Society have produced 2 blue plaques. One is at the foreshore of the Langston, which overlooks Langston and Emsworth harbours, and that's to commemorate the trialling of the Cockle canoes and the assault landing craft and the men and women that served in them and all the training they did in those waters right the way down to Hailing Island Sailing Club. And the other plaque is to go on the house that he lived in just down the road from there, Moss Rose.
Lovely. And you've got some VIPs coming along, haven't you?
We certainly have. We've got Major Ram Seeger, who's ex-SBS. He was commanding officer of the SBS, and he's very kindly agreed to unveil both plaques. We also have Mike Bettridge, MBE, ex-SBS and chairman of the SBSA, and his good wife, Captain Carol Bettridge, OBE, and various other. We've got lots of MBEs and OBEs. It's quite wonderful.
And final thought, Jill, how proud are you of your granddad?
Oh, I'm just busting. I can't yeah? Tell you. Yeah, very emotional and so proud. The whole family are. And we just hope everybody has a fantastic day.
What a day, what a story. And look, Jill, thank you very much for being on BBC Radio 7 this morning. I'm very grateful to you. All the very best.
Thank you very much, Julian. I really appreciate all your support.
Pleasure. That's Jill Goulding on the wartime exploits of her grandfather, Commander Harold Goulding, DSO, and before that, our reporter, Dominic Blake, and all those things happening later. So if you're wondering why there's a flotilla, a flypast, and all these things happening, now you know a bit more about it. You heard it here on Solent. It's 7:45.
That was Julian Clegg speaking to Jill Goulding, who discovered a briefcase with top secret documents of her grandfather's in her loft. And she's been finding out ever since about the key role that her granddad played, Harold Goulding, in World War II as the commander of UK Coastal Forces for the Royal Navy. And that recording was from August 2015. And I also spoke to Quentin Rees, who's a friend of Jill's, and he wrote a book called cockle shell canoes. Also, about the Navy in World War II.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
My name is Quentin Rees, and I've written Cockle Shell Canoes, published in 2008, about 7 years of research. And in 2010, I had published the Cockle Shell Canoes, The Final Witness, which is is about the Frankton Raid, the famous Cockle Shell Heroes Raid.
Can you tell us a bit about that raid for those that have never come across it before? Why is it significant?
It was hailed as a very successful raid, even though only two of the 10 men came back alive. It was thought, to be honest, an impossible thing to do, and nobody was really expected to come back. It was an audacious thing in 1942, not only because the RMPPD, the Royal Marines Boom Patrol Detachment, had only been set up in July and the operation was underway at the beginning of December. It was not only audacious in its approach, but the fact that most of the men could not swim, none of them had any navigation experience at all, and none of them had any seamanship skills, because all of those that had those any kind of skills were taken already by other organisations or other units, such as the COPS.
Can you put it into context, how this fitted into the wider World War II, this raid?
The reason why it was hailed as being successful and significant, of which it was significant, but it wasn't successful, because it was really speculative. It showed what could be done, but even the commanding officer knew that it really couldn't be done once it had been done once for the first time. It was an endurance event. For instance, they were expected to rendezvous, which is the first time it had been done, with an organisation within France that were going to get them out. None of them could speak French. As I said, in July 42, the Royal Marines Boom Patrol Detachment was set up at Southsea, and by December the operation was underway. They left from Greenock in a submarine, HMS Tuna. They stopped at Scalpsea Bay for their first real trials of getting canoes in and out by the methods they used. And then they sailed to just off of the French coast of Royan. And they then launched their canoes. Only five of the six canoes were launched. And then they paddled at night to the Port of Bordeaux over six nights, and to place limpet mines on access shipping. As I said, it was speculative. They had no intelligence to determine what cargo was on where and so on and so on. And as it turned out, there was worse to come, because even though the limpets did explode, none of the ships were loaded, and they merely sank to the bottom of the silted estuary whilst tied up at the quay. There's some interesting photographs to show that. Within the next day, they were refloated, and within about 3 weeks, the worst affected ship was afloat and ready to go. So, in effect, it cost vast majority of the men their lives for a pointless exercise.
So that does sound like a failure. Were lessons learned from that?
By Hasler, it affected Hasler. It was muted that they should go again, and Hasler gave the 5-1 against it succeeding, and saying that they were very lucky to get the conditions that they needed to have to launch, and all the other lucky escapes that they went through, he wasn't for it. I didn't have any problems with the authorities per se. It was only after the book was published that certain individuals didn't like what I'd written, because it was a bit too near the bone, and also it really was exposing the whole event, warts and all. Not to any detriment to any to the commanding officer Hasler, because I was very polite to him as well, but I told the story as it was and made sure that it was up to the reader to determine the conclusion, shall we say.
So, I mean, there obviously there had been a bit of history written about it beforehand. What did you uncover you think that they didn't like?
I uncovered about 50% new history. Most of that was to do with the surround, you know, the men, the French people hadn't been talked about before and so on. But, as I said, the main crux of it was the fact that history had been written before, and it was what a wonderful war, as it were, and didn't we do well? But you cannot undertake an operation which has no real aim, i.e. this was a speculative, it wasn't going, oh, they've got this in this ship and it's going to sail, so we've got to get to it at a certain point. There was none of that. There was the next book I should be writing will explain an awful lot more, but when it was like they were filling in the gaps to make something look good, when in fact it wasn't. And I think the commanding officer post-war definitely realised that. He came to his senses, shall we say. There's lots of things that went wrong during World War II, as most wars. This was just one insignificant thing that became significant, basically through a small amount of narrative, written narrative, and through the Cockshell Heroes film, which was not really representative.
So that's the famous, most people will come across the Cockleshell Heroes film. What do you think you've added to history from that, and how accurate was the original film?
Original film, not very accurate at all. I could go on and on and on about it. Suffice it to say that Hasler washed his hands of it some way into the making of. He was a consultant, as was Sparks. They both got paid a small amount of money. It was an American-based film. They wanted to make it populist, didn't they? So it was based on a theme which wasn't really representative at all. As I said, Hasler wasn't very happy, so that's why he determined that he was going to go. It's more complicated than that, but that, in effect, was what happened.
So what drives you as a military historian? What gets you out of bed in the morning and gets you going for a good story?
I like uncovering stuff that hasn't been told before. The first book I wrote was it really nearly put me in the mental institute, because I couldn't quite work it out. It was 97% new history, and when you're trying to work it out, getting down to the nitty gritty about different things, it sounds very easy now, but at the time I couldn't work out certain things at all. And eventually, over the 7-year period, it was pieced together and it became a wonderful story. And that's the thing, I suddenly realised it was a wonderful story to be told. And part of that story was, funny enough, my introduction with the Goulding family was when I gave a talk at the Hayling Island Sailing Club, Jill's brother came and said, "This is my grandfather," and subsequent reprint made sure that Harold Goulding's name was duly added to that caption. And that was the beginning of my association with the Goulding family. And it's been a difficult thing, and still will be a difficult thing, to get down to the nitty-gritty. And I give you for instance, I've noticed in the small amount of research, because the next book will encompass Harold, but not entirely to do with him himself. But when you look at correspondence between individuals, they mention him, but they do not even talk about what he gets up to. It's like, well, you know what he's doing, and so on and so on. but we can't really mention it, even in a letter, which I find really odd. So something quite, I would say, big was afoot. Haven't got down to the bottom of it yet.
Harold Goulding was got a DSO. He died right at the end of the war, but he was the officer commanding the special boat unit, which encompassed most of what was going on Hayling Island, training commandos and all sorts of things related to special operations, naval special operations. What's your take on why he was effectively written out of history?
I think in the big swing of things, he was a very small cog. And don't forget that the SBU, the special boat unit, this wasn't set up until 1944, and it encompassed the RMPPD, Royal Marines Boom Patrol Detachment, COPS, Beach Clearance Unit, SBS, and so on. Special boat service, it's not the same as special boat service what it is now, but they all had different operational activities. The RMPPD, it grew. All these units tended to grow. We eventually had only started with two sections. One section was basically wiped out, as we know. That remained in name only. And then number two, three and four were put together. And the RMPPD had interesting kit, like the Sleeping Beauty, which is basically a canoe that can sail and be paddled, but it is electrically propelled and it can dive to up to about 45 feet. And did so off of Hayling Island, South Sea, and all kinds of places. Now, funny enough, that was actually designed. It was called Quentin Reeves, which spooked me out something terribly at the time. And so they had a more get to the harbour and beat up the enemy type of activity, as opposed to the cops who were really and I must be forgiven for saying this, the professionals, in the sense that they were high on the navigation and seamanship agenda, where they, you know, these were the guys who would, under the enemy's noses literally, go to beaches and take the necessary soundings, everything, you know, where certain rocks were for the Normandy landings. And it cannot be stressed enough how much the nation, or, you know, was owed to these guys. And the strange thing about it was, you know, we had secret clandestine organisations, the COPS were. The COPS would have themselves, much like Goulding, faded insignificance if it hadn't have been for an American journalist who stumbled upon the COPS and then sort of exposed it. Not exposed, but brought the story to the forefront. Because back, as with, well, most wars, everything's hush-hush, certainly World War II. So you have an indoctrination whereby you don't talk about it. And I know people who were in there when I first started research and were very tentative of talking to me about things that really they shouldn't have been tentative of talking to me about at all, because it was a long time since the war.
I know even Jill Goulding's grandmother,
yes.
Right up until the day she died, she took all this very seriously. Yeah. Official Secrets Act, I'm not going to breathe a word about it.
Yeah, indeed. And she wasn't in the forces. She was married to a guy who was. But obviously that indoctrination still held, because they, you know, and not only that, people, when you're doing something, you don't think it's special. That's the point. You know, you think everybody's doing exactly the same thing. You know, whether you're a journalist or you think everybody can do what you do, and it's not quite right. And that's the thing, the wonderful thing about that era. And not only that, if you think about it logically, when you're faced with a world war, at the end of that, when it's all over, you really don't want to remember it. And I think it's, let's get on with our ordinary lives. And I don't think it started off as a conspiracy or anything like that. I think, like with most things, unless it was highlighted like the Cockshell Heroes thing, in the events leading up to it, and it grew, and then somebody, you know, bit the apple and thought, oh, we could make a film out of it. That's what popularised it. And unless you popularise it, it dies of death. And that's... It captures a nation's interest at the time. And in 1956, whatever, that was of interest. Nowadays, you don't really see that many war films because we're not that interested in that kind of thing.
Yeah, but there is another thing about the present era that a lot of the people who, the last people who remember activities from World War II are now passing away, aren't they?
Yeah, and a lot has been done recording voices. If you go to Q, Public Record Office, you can see written depositions, and there's various other sources you can go to and listen to depositions from civilians and those that served in the forces. And but when you do that, you can't necessarily take it... you cannot be sure that what they're saying, especially, is accurate. And the reason I say that is because you have, as a researcher, you have to understand the time of life that they gave that deposition, and memories fade and so on. So the earlier you get to people and you record what they say, the better. And if you go back to the same person a few years and so on, with Sparks especially, who was a survivor of the Frankton raid with Hasler, his commanding officer, because he was in the same canoe, you suddenly see there's a pattern whereby some certain things are elaborated and so on and so on. So you've, as a historian, you've got to try and brush away and all the rubbish, shall we say, you know is not true. And then it's probability, and then you've got to back it up with something else. It's not like being a journalist to a certain extent, but it can be a difficult thing. With the Canoes book, it was pretty straightforward in the big swing of things. It was just working out what the hell was going on.
Well, just remind us how people can find your books, your name, and what the books are, and you know your work that's available at the moment.
Ah, that's going to be a bit of a problem, because the first book, The Cockleshell Canoe, sold out within 6 months, and then it was reprinted. Unless thousands of people determine that they want to buy the book, the publishers will probably not reprint it, but hopefully they will. But you might be able to get one on Amazon. However, The Cockleshell Heroes, The Final Witness, I know there are some small softbacks still available. But unfortunately, that sold out equally well on the first three reprints, and seems to be coming to an end on the fourth reprint, so it's getting there soon. But eBay.
But all these books are available on the, you know, Bookfinder and these other things, aren't they?
Yes, I pity the person who buys some of them, because I have seen one for £300, which is extraordinary considering it only cost £15 in the first place, or £19 in the first place. But it's well worth it.
That was Quentin Rees there, and his book, Cockleshell Canoes. That's all for this week. Dialects Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car. And you could subscribe and listen the week before broadcast if you want at dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, John Bamfield from Bath, also Jill Golding and Julian Clegg from Radio Solent, and Quentin Rees. Also studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street, on 0117 909 6897. They're online at prsc.org.uk. You can volunteer with us, or for hundreds of opportunities elsewhere in Britain, via the National Volunteering website. That's do-it.org. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week, where we hear more from John Bamfield. Goodbye for now.
Cigarettes, holding hands and yawning, look how late it gets. two sleepy people by dawn's early light, and too much in love to say goodnight. Here we are in the cozy chair, picking on a wishbone from the frigid air. Two sleepy people with nothing to say, and too much in love to break away. Do you remember the night we used to linger in the hall? Your father didn't like me at all. Do you remember the reason why we married in the fall? To rent this little nest and get a bit of rest. Well, here we are, just about the same. Foggy little fella, drowsy little dame. Two sleepy people by dawn's early light, and too much in love to say goodnight.